Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the entertainment world. To listeners that grew up during the 1960s, my guest today needs absolutely no introduction. For a decade, he ruled the airwaves. In 1962, the world started to take notice with the release of the single Sheila. Hit after hit came along, and 1969 saw the release of Dizzy. Pretty much, Dizzy topped the charts in just about every country other than Outer Mongolia. It is my great pleasure to welcome Tommy Rowe to the program. Tommy, hello.
Simon, thank you. And it was a hit in Outer Mongolia. It just got the number two. It didn't reach number one.
Darn it.
How you doing, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing just great.
How you doing today? You doing okay?
I'm doing wonderful. Tommy, I do hope you're not in a big rush today, because we have lots to talk about.
Well, I'm at your disposal for a little while here. I don't know how long it'll go. Maybe 30 minutes or so, huh?
Okay. Well, we'll just play it by ear.
Okay. There you go.
I was talking yesterday with my wife Jan, and her eyes got really big when I mentioned your name. In fact, she said to me, "You know what? I was 11 years old when Sweet Pea was released." I mean, would you mind terribly if we played Sweet Pea?
Oh, I'd love to hear it. Of course, I always love to hear my records.
Okay. So, this is Sweet Pea.
Won't you see my girl? I went to a dance to see her.
Actually, Jen has put on a few years since it was originally broadcast, but we do have her on the line. Jen, would you like to say hello to Tommy Rowe?
Yes, I would.
Tommy, hello, Jen.
So
how you doing?
I am great, and I hope you are as well. And thank you so much. This has really brought back some good memories in my life, and I really enjoy listening to your music.
I have always listened to it. Thank you so much. That's nice.
Thank you for giving this to me.
When I hear Sweet Pea, it reminds me of, it was used in the movie Jesus Son. And there's a scene in there where the girl is dancing and everybody's sitting around smoking pot, and she's dancing to Sweet Pea. And I'm thinking, that's not what they're supposed to do to my song. That's not. But they seem to be having a really good time with Sweet Pea. So I kind of enjoyed that movie, Jesus Son.
I don't think I've seen it, but I do enjoy your music.
Well, thank you so much, Jen.
Okay, I'll let y'all have it back now.
Okay.
A question that I've asked many musicians, can one song become a millstone around your neck? And some musicians say yes. You know, there's one tune that you have to play in a concert. Do you find that?
Well, not at all. I'm just glad I have some songs that I have to play in concert. I mean, the alternative is not so bright, you know, to have something that nobody wants to hear.
Oh, all of your songs are delightful. I mean,
I love singing my songs. You know, every time I do them, it's different. You know, I have the mood is different because the venues are different, and it always feels fresh and new to me each time I do them. So, not at all. I love singing the hits. I mean, what's really hard is trying to sing the new songs that people aren't familiar with. You know, if I write a new song and I try to do it in concert, they don't seem to be too interested in that.
Actually, your first hit, I think, was in 62,
right.
Sheila. What did you do prior to that? I mean, what is your musical background?
Well, that was really prior. I mean, Sheila I wrote when I was 14 years old. And actually, I wrote a poem when I was 14 years old about a girl I went to school with, and her name was Frida. So the poem was called Sweet Little Frida. And about the same time, my father taught me three chords on the guitar, and I thought, I know, I'll put some music to my poem Frida and I will be a songwriter. So I did that, and then I auditioned to make a record with this record producer, and I sang Frida for him, and he loved the song, but he hated the title. So he said, you know, you need to go home and work on it and come up with a new title. So as we say, when there's nothing left to say, the rest is history. I changed the name of the song, and it became my first hit. I'd written Sheila when I was 14, and I wrote another song called Caveman, and I wrote another song called I Got a Girl. So I wrote those songs when I was in, you know, middle of high school, very young guy.
Okay, now, what age were you when Sheila was actually recorded and released?
I was 20 years old.
You were 20?
Right.
Wow. And suddenly you're thrust into the limelight.
Yeah, that was scary.
Actually, the story I heard, and I pulled it off the internet, so who knows if it's true. You were actually working for GE, soldering wires or something.
Right.
And you weren't sure about this whole music business.
Right. Yeah, I was married very young. I had a little girl, and So I had this job at General Electric, and they made the electronics for the turbines that go into dams to generate energy, you know. So I used to work on these turbines, putting the wires together, soldering these wires together for these things. And so I get this, I recorded this song, and I'm still working at General Electric. So I get this call from the guy who produced it, and he said, you know, you need to start thinking about quitting your job at General Electric, because it looks like Sheila is going to be a big record, big hit. And I immediately said, no way. You know, there's no way I can quit my job. You know, I was making like 80 bucks a week or something, had my pension plan going and the whole thing. I wasn't about to quit my job. So he laughed, and then he said, well, look, when you get off work this afternoon, come by the office and we'll talk about it and see what we can do. So I went by his office after work and go into his office. Bill Lowry was his name. He ended up being my manager. And he said, Tommy, you got to really quit your job because Sheila's like number 35 or 40 in Billboard magazine with a bullet. I didn't even know what the hell Billboard magazine with a bullet was. I had no idea what he was talking about. And I said, well, is that good? He said, yeah. He laughed. He said, yeah, of course it's good. It means your record's climbing the charts, and it looks like it's going to be a top 10 record. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, it means you need to quit your job and start concentrating on your music career. And I said, well, I just can't do that, Bill. He laughed again, reached into his desk and pulled out his checkbook and wrote me a check for $10,000. Well, that's more money in 1962 than I made in the whole year that I worked at General Electric, you know. So, I mean, I thought he was kidding. I said, you got to be joking. I said, no, that's an advance against royalties. And I said, my God, this is something else. I got to think really heavy on this now. This is getting serious. So I go home that evening, discuss it with my parents. And, of course, my dad didn't even make $10,000 a year, you know. So we talked it over and said, well, we might as well give it a try. We got nothing to lose, you know, at least for a year. So I quit my job. And sure enough, Sheila ends up being number one record in all over the world, actually, in England, America, Germany, everywhere it was played, it ended up being number one. And so I never went back to GE. That was it. That was the only honest job I ever had was General Electric.
I'll tell you what, I love your music so much. I want to leap right into another musical extravaganza. I'm not sure this one was a huge hit, but I really like it. It's Now Winter's Day.
Oh, okay, thank you. That's my favorite song I've ever written.
Really?
I think it's the best song I've ever written in my life. Yeah, I think I'm glad you like that. It was never a big hit, but I really like the song as a song. I love it. So thank you, Simon. I'm glad you like that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's listen to it.
Okay.
Everyone is warm inside. Their houses in the snow. The mercury is dropping down to minus 10 below. Outside it's chilling, but inside it's thrilling. With fireplaces burning and records that keep turning. The trees have turned brown. The sky has gone gray. It's now winter's day. The parks, they're all empty. No squeaks from the swing. No kids are at play. Other's arms, listening to silent sounds as the snow pats the ground. Perfumed hair that I smell, dropping down to minus 10 below. Outside it's chilling, but inside it's thrilling, with fireplaces burning and records that keep turning.
Now, Winter's Day is a very, very different song from Sweet Pea.
Oh yeah, and I have to say, Simon, that is not me singing that. That's Daddy C, who is actually a recording artist from he lives in Pennsylvania, and he recorded my song and put it up on YouTube, and I put it on my website because he did such a great version of it. And he's gotten huge hits on that song since he put it up on YouTube. So just to make it clear, that's not me singing that. That's my song. I wrote it, but that's Daddy C is the artist.
Is it a song that you do play live?
Oh, yeah, I do it in my show. Absolutely, yeah. Sometimes I do it acoustically, and other times I'll do it with an arrangement with the band. It just depends on, you know, the situation. But I always do the song, absolutely, yeah.
Actually, off air, you mentioned the name Rick Levy. I was talking to Rick yesterday. We were talking all about you.
Uh-huh.
And he sent me a truly delightful track, and it's one that I certainly had not heard before. And you know, I asked my expert Jan, and she said, "Nope, I don't recall hearing this one before." Bluebird, Every Time a Bluebird Cries.
Oh yeah. We're gonna do that in our show up in Canada. You know, it's funny about that song. I recorded that in England. It was written by Victor Mal, and they wanted to do a recording session with me over there, and they gave me this song to record, which I love the song. And it was never released, it was released in England and a few other places. I don't think it was ever released in the States. Might have been released in Canada. But, you know, the finite wisdom of the record executives at my record label decided they'd put this song on my greatest hits CD. And it was never a hit, which is an amazing thing. But, you know, it could be a hit because the song is really cool. I love the song. I didn't write the song, but I love the song.
Oh, I, you know, when I heard it yesterday, I said to my boss Jan, "You got to listen to this. I mean, this is unbelievable. I mean, it is such a fun song, and you know, it fits right into." You know, your style, your genre. In fact, I know that many of our listeners have never heard it before.
No,
so,
it's really obscure. Yeah, it's really an obscure song, obscure record. I'm not sure if it's ever been released or not. I know it was in England, but I don't think it's been released anywhere else.
Okay, so everyone in North America, here's a first. Hmm.
You know, back then it was funny. There was so much politics in the business. See, they wanted me to record this in England, so I went to England and recorded. It was very British sounding. And so they didn't release it in the States because I think in the States they didn't want to release something that was done over there. You know, it's really weird stuff. But I always thought it was a hit myself, and I wondered why it was never released. It was just bizarre, you know. But that's, you know, that happens in the record business sometimes. You just... people don't realize what goes on behind the scenes in the record business, you know.
And actually, that segues rather nicely into my next question. I mean, the music business is not an easy one. You know, I've talked to lots of people and heard lots of horror stories. You have a platinum selling album. You come off a sold out world tour playing, you know, 50,000 seat arenas,
right,
only discover that you're in the red with the record label.
surprise!
I am not joking. Yeah, this is absolute serious.
Yeah, it happened. It happened a lot in the 70s, and I imagine it's still happening today. You know, the record labels, for one thing, when you go in and record an album, and the album back then would cost about $500,000, say $500,000 to do an album. Okay, that means you owe the record label, before you get any royalties, you owe the record label $500,000. Well, if they put up money for tour support, which they also did in those days, then say they put up another $500,000 for tour support. Well, you're in the hole $1 million, but before you get one royalty. So, so to get out of that hole, I mean, you almost have to work forever to get out of the hole. So it's just bizarre. You know, I'm probably very fortunate because I get record royalties because I was out of the hole before I left the label. You know, I never was in the hole. I always paid for my own sessions. So I always got royalties. I still get royalties to this day, you know. So it's, you know, I don't know if I was smart or I just happened to do the right thing or what, but it was just the way I did it. So, I know what you're talking about. I've heard those stories myself. It's just crazy. I mean, these guys sell millions of records, and they end up, a lot of them end up with no money. It's just bizarre.
Right. And also, I think most of your records, you have songwriting credits for, and you didn't relinquish them, which is
Well, that's what I tell all of the young artists today. I mean, if I go to a seminar or something, which I have done occasionally, and they always ask, you know, how to get started. You know, the typical questions: what did you do to get started, and what's the best thing to do? And I always stress to them, the main thing you have to do as a pop artist, especially a rock artist or pop artist of any kind, is to write your own material. Because that's the only way you'll ever really be sure to make any money. Because if you have a hit, you're guaranteed royalties through BMI or ASCAP or whoever handles your publishing. And you get royalties from day one. If you have a song on a hit album, you don't have to get out of the hole because you're not in the hole. You get paid from first record sold. So the key is to write your own music. That's where the Beatles, I mean, let's face it, Paul McCartney has made all of the money from the songwriting. I mean, that's just tons of money that he's made off songwriting. So that is the key. Write your own material. That way you'll make a really good living in the music business.
Oh, I'm in complete agreement with you. I've heard so many horror stories. You know,
yeah, sure.
Just not funny. Now, I do want to ask you this, and I do hope that you won't hang up the phone and stomp off in a huff. You know, some people label you as the inventor of bubblegum pop.
I was called the king of bubblegum. Let's not minimize it. I was the king of bubblegum. I started that genre. So I am very proud of that, Simon. I am very proud of that. Believe me. I laugh all the way to the bank.
But I don't really see your songs as bubblegum.
Well, the reason, let me explain why they called it bubblegum. Because when I first started recording, I was very young, so I had a real teen audience. I mean, some cases preteens, 14, 15-year-old kids. So the DJs didn't know what to call it. I mean, it's like, well, is he rock and roll? Is he pop? What is he? So I was just kind of in between all these things. So they came up with this bubblegum thing, which in the beginning it was a negative. They treated it as a negative, but I took it as it was my thing. I mean, I was the only one doing it. That's probably the reason I managed to have hits during the decade of the 60s, where most of the American artists were dropped off the charts with the British invasion. When the British acts started coming to America, most of the American acts lost chart success. I mean, they couldn't sustain their success. I managed to have hits all during the 60s with my style of music because I was the one that created it. I mean, you had, you know, Yummy Yummy and these other acts that did songs that could have been my records. They sounded like me, you know, but I was very proud of what I was doing. Still am.
And I mean, you must have been, you know, sitting back, you know, looking at the music scene and going, wow, I must be doing something right. Everyone's copying me.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the way I looked at it. And, you know, the people like to throw stones. You know, when you're successful, you know, they'll you know how it goes. They'll build you up, make you successful, and then they love to bring you down. You know, I mean, that's where I was at the peak of my career at the end of the 60s. You know, everybody was gunning for me because I was having a lot of chart success, and it was very competitive back then. You know, everybody was trying to get on the radio. It was hard to get on the radio. And I was on the radio all the time. So, you know, it's just the way things work. But, it worked for me. And I'm proud of my songs. I wrote them from the heart. And, you know, they're not deep, you know, meaningful as far as political statements or anything like that. But they're fun songs. And that's really what I was all about.
Well, I don't think that a successful song has to have some, you know, deep political message. It has to be something that people want to listen to. And
yeah, of course.
Your songs are songs that people want to listen to.
Yeah, well, thank you. I hope so. I hope they still do. It's for one thing, it's fun. I mean, it's lighthearted, fun music, and, you know, that's what it's all about for me. So
we're going to play another track in a minute, but before we get there, I do have to ask you, what happened in the 70s? Did you just, you know, back off and say enough?
Well, I had some personal problems in the early 70s. My last chart record was Stagger Lee in like 72, I think it was. And then, you know, I was having personal problems with my marriage and the whole thing. And I, you know, I also made some poor choices back then. I did some things that I probably shouldn't have done and caught a lot of flack about it. But and so it hurt my career. But it was time for me to back off. I needed a little sabbatical anyway. So, you know, I took some time off. But I found it very difficult to get back into the business when I wanted to. It was like, it was very hard to get started again in the late 70s. I started trying to work again, and it was, you know, it was just, well, that was the disco craze, too. You know, disco was real hot, and it was really hard for an act to get a job to perform. And all the clubs were closed, everything was disco, and, you know, it was just hard to get any work. So, but towards the end of the 70s and early 80s, there was a big resurgence of the nostalgia shows, and I got involved with those, and, you know, I did those through the 80s and the 90s for, like, I guess, close to 20 years doing those kind of shows, and they were very successful, so.
Okay, let's take another quick musical excursion. How do you feel about Heather Honey?
Heather Honey's a nice song. That was the follow-up to Dizzy. It was the song that I wrote to... I got the idea for that song. I was working in England, and I used to smoke a pipe every once in a while, and I would go to the tobacconist in England, and there was a Heather Honey pipe tobacco. So I walked by the tobacconist one day, and I saw this little pouch of tobacco that said Heather Honey. I said, man, that's a song title. So I went in and bought the tobacco and wrote a song about it over there in England. So that's where I got the idea for that. And it was a pretty good record. It wasn't as big as Dizzy, but it was a big chart record.
Okay. Well, why don't we listen to Heather Honey?
Great.
Here.
Pretty little song.
Thank you.
It really is. And it's musically fabulous. There's nothing you can complain about.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, you know, I love making those records. All of the stuff that I did, for one thing, I had great musicians on my sessions. You know, I had, Hal Blaine was playing drums on Dizzy and Heather Honey, and Joe Osborne on bass, and Larry Nechtel, who passed away recently, and all these great musicians. And, you know, I never really did this for money. I mean, I did this because it was such a joy to do. I mean, it made me feel good to do these songs, and the money was not a thing that was the objective of this. It was like going in and trying to make a good, solid record with the song I'd written, you know, and that was the whole point of the process. So, and I think it comes through with that. I mean, it's like it's innocent, you know. It's like spontaneous. It's all those things that make music wonderful, you know, and that's what I was trying to capture anyway when I recorded.
Right. I just love the music. I listen to so much music that, things tend to get pigeonholed away. And, you know, when I discovered that I was going to be talking to you, yeah, I started to, dig in and re-listen, and I'm going, oh, wow, this is wonderful stuff.
Well, that's nice. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I was actually going to save this for the very end of the program, but seeing as you've mentioned the song, I think, three times, I really do think that we should give Dizzy an airing. What do you think?
Well, I think the show would just... Simon, you can't end the show without playing Dizzy, let's face it. I mean, that would
right.
be one.
Well,
Freddie Weller and I wrote Dizzy, and it's funny, when I sat down with Freddie the first time to write this song, I said, Freddie, look, now, all of my songs, first time we'd tried to write anything together, I said, all of my songs have modulations in them, so we got to somehow work a modulation in this song. He said, well, why don't we do it in the first two bars? And I just looked at him and said, how can you do that? He said, well, look, let's just do this. It's D, G, B, we're in E now. That's the first two bars of the song. You've modulated already. So it was amazing, and it worked so well. I thought, my God, that's fantastic. So we ended up writing that song, and it took us a little while to finish it. I started the song on a bus tour with Paul Revere and the Raiders, and Freddie came in the middle of it and helped me finish the song. So it worked.
Yeah, it's just too good a song not to play. But, I was a little concerned that, you know, you might say, oh, no, not Dizzy again.
I told you earlier, I love all my songs. They're like, each one of them is like a different child, you know. They have their own personality, and I love them all.
Okay, so this is Dizzy from 1969.
Easy.
Yeah, like I said, I just could not resist playing that.
Yeah, great, great.
Okay, enough of the past. Let's talk about the present and the future.
Okay.
I understand, and, you know, I have eyes and ears everywhere.
I'll
bet
you
And basically, you can blame Rick Levy.
Yeah, I blame him for everything. He's a good target.
I didn't say this. I understand that you're going to do a couple of concerts in the near future.
Yes. Rick finally got me back out on the road. I retired in 2006 from travel. I just got burnt out on traveling. You know, it was just too much flying around, and I did it for so long. So I retired from the road, and from the day one, the last concert I did was with Rick. And from day one, he said, "I got to get you back out there." So he's been working on this for 5 years now. So he's finally succeeded, and we have two dates booked up in Canada. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And he came up with the idea of doing a show called The Evening with Tommy Rowe, and we're going to do a little. I want to talk to the audience about kind of what we're talking about, you know, the career and how I got started and the whole thing, and do a few acoustical things. So I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun for me.
I think this is happening in May.
Right, May 19th and 20th. We're in Saskatchewan and Alberta.
Whoa, lucky you. Let's hope the snow has melted.
Yeah, I think it should be very nice in May. Of course, you know, in Canada, in May you can get some lousy weather too. But, you know, a little weather is not bad. It's not going to hurt us. We'll be inside.
Okay. Look, let's do an absolutely shameless commercial thing.
Okay.
Do you have a web page? You know, can someone type in www.something or other?
Sure, just TommyRoe.com. Yeah, easy. And it's TommyRoe, one word, you know, .com. And my website is not really interactive. It's more or less a billboard of, you know, stuff that I've done and doing, and kind of, you know, I keep it up to date with what's going on. But it's not interactive. In other words, I don't really, you know, interact with the viewers of the website. So
I'll have to
explain myself. When I first started my website, I thought, boy, this is great. I'm going to get to communicate with my fans. It was so overwhelming. I mean, it was like 24/7. I had emails coming, and, you know, from all over the place, and I was trying to answer them and trying to do the right thing, and it's impossible for me to do personally. So I said, I'm just going to put the billboard up there. It's a billboard. There is a Tommy Rowe billboard.
I was going to say, oh my goodness, you've just become a grumpy old man.
Yeah. It's not that. It's just that I was overwhelmed by it. I mean, when I first started the internet thing, I was in the beginning in 1996, I think, is when I started it. And that was just really in the beginning of it. And I thought, well, this is it's easy. I just thought of it as a simple little thing of communication, you know. Well, it just grew and grew. Like, nobody expected the internet to grow as it did. And it just got to be something that you need an office, you need a staff of 13 or 15 people to do all that stuff. So, so I'm a lazy old guy. What can I say?
I have to ask you. Hindsight is 2020, and I'll be honest with you. I can see no flaws in Tommy Rowe. Maybe you can. Is there anything in retrospect you would have done differently?
Oh my, that's a hard question. You know, of course there's things that I wish I had done differently. Success changes you, you know. And when I first started, I was just innocent and eager, and you know, as the success got bigger and bigger, you get more arrogant and more full of yourself. And I think I did a little bit of that and turned some people off. But you know, I wouldn't want to do that again. I mean, it took me a while to really find out what Tommy Roe is all about and who I am and feel comfortable in my skin, and which, you know, right now is the best time of my life. I feel so good about my life. I have a great marriage and, you know, family. My daughters are grown. I have grandchildren. And, you know, everything is good with me. And, you know, there's some things that, you know, you cross people through in the business and you get the repercussions from it. And I'm sure I did that. And, you know, it's regretful. I think it hurt my career, but... you know, that's the way it is. I would change those things. I was immature in that respect. You know, I didn't know how to really handle business that well. So.
Oh, we all learn with age.
Yeah, you know, it's part of that growing process, and you just sometimes you make mistakes that you can't take back. And all in all, though, I think the whole thing that salvaged it all for me is, like we talked about earlier, was the songwriting. I mean, it was just something that was solid and it worked and people listened to it and bought it. And, you know, without that, I would have just been another singer, you know. So not that I'm not that now, but, I mean, at least I did have some success and along the way. And, you know, so that was good.
Oh, I think you've had tremendous success. One of the other things that I hear from you know, people that were prevalent in the 60s and 70s that are still, you know, doing a concert every other night, you know, is the fact that they have no opportunity for new music. Audiences don't want to hear new stuff, but they want to hear the old stuff. Do you find that?
I absolutely. I mean, that I think we discussed that earlier. Maybe there's another interview. I've been doing interviews all day, so my interviews are all running together now, but. I was talking about that earlier, about doing concerts and trying to introduce a new song into the show, you know. It just lays flat. It doesn't happen. I mean, they want to hear the hits. They want to hear what they're familiar with. And they want that feeling of nostalgia. They want you to bring back that feeling of nostalgia when they first heard that song on the radio. What it felt like in that moment and the way things smell and felt and the girl you was with or the boy you was with, whatever, you know. That's what they want at these concerts. And it's very difficult to introduce new music. And you can't get new music played on the oldies station. They just won't play it. So it's very difficult for guys like me to introduce new music into the marketplace. There's no real outlet. There's no place to do it, you know. So,
okay, but let's say you had some new music. Would you consider creating a CD and just floating it around?
Well, I would really love to go back into the studio and record under the right circumstances where I felt like that, you know, we could really make some good music, good musicians, good, you know, the whole thing was, you felt good about it. And in other words, when you walked out of the studio, you'd feel like you made some great records. And if they happen, fantastic. If they don't happen, at least you made some great records. And I would love to do that. Yeah, that would be terrific. I've thought about going over to England and maybe trying to record over there, put something together and record over there. I think the community over there is more receptive to something like what I would want to do, you know. But, you know, we'll see. I'm just getting started back with this concert thing, and we'll see what materializes from it. I'm open to anything that's productive and positive in the music business. And if a producer has an idea or something, I'm absolutely open to whatever we can do in the music business.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. We're running, or the clock is running down. Got about 6 minutes left.
Okay.
Can we play one more tune?
Sure.
How do you feel about Everybody?
Oh, that's one of my favorite ones. I love that song. I love doing it in the show. You know, it's a energy. It's got energy, you know, and I love. We recorded that in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and one of the first hits that was cut down there. I don't know if you're familiar with Muscle Shoals, Alabama. A lot of hit records were made down there. And this was recorded in 1963, and I wrote this song after the Beatles tour that I did in England. And because they were doing, like, 50s rock and roll in their show, they were doing a lot of rockabilly kind of sounding stuff, and they inspired me to write this song, and I wrote it on the Queen Elizabeth coming back to New York from England after the Beatles tour. And I wrote Everybody on the Ship coming back.
Okay.
So,
this
let's play
is Everybody.
It. Let's play it, yeah.
There is a certain Beatles influence about that tune.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that raw rock and roll thing that they were doing. I mean, that's kind of how they sounded on stage. You know, it was very raw sounding. And that was definitely influenced me in writing that song, for sure.
Oh, all of your songs are so well done, but I don't believe that you have any formal training in music writing.
None whatsoever. I mean, my dad taught me to play the guitar, you know, and my mom played piano in church, and, you know, typical Southern story, you know, grew up in a Christian home with the church music and all that. And that's how I got into music. It was very family oriented. You know, back in those times, I remember when I was a kid, before TV and we had radio, but before TV, the family would always, and I'm talking about family, big family, cousins, nephews, aunts, uncles, would all get together and play music. I mean, that's what we did for entertainment. You know, we'd go to grandma's house and sit out on the front porch and play music. And all my family... all my dad's brothers played some kind of an instrument, you know. So, and my grandfather played banjo. So it was always I grew up with that. And the songwriting, I don't know where that came from. That was just something, you know, that's God's gift. I can't explain songwriting. It's just something that I was able to do at a very young age and managed to make a career out of it. And I just don't know where it comes from. It's just a gift.
Tommy, my producer is whining in my ear.
My
other producer.
Oh, okay.
Jen's my boss.
Okay. Okay. Well, listen, it was great talking with you, Simon. I love your show. It's a very nice, comfortable, laid-back show. It's a pleasure to be on with you. So thanks for inviting me.
And Tommy, you are invited back anytime. In fact, I want to talk to you after your excursion to the Great White North and find out how gigging was.
Okay, cool. We'll do it.
Okay. Till next time, this is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a happy and healthy day, and we'll be back again soon. Tommy Rowe, you are a legend.
Well, thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
Okay, bye.